Let's call a meeting of February 15th, Jobs and Economic Development Finance Committee to order. And Representative Scalzi, did you read the minutes?
I did, and I noticed that I was here, and thank you for that. And I would move the minutes.
Very well. Representative Scalzi moves the minutes of February 10th to be approved and passed. All those people in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you very much. Rebecca thanks you, too. It's good to have Rebecca back. It's a sad time for her, but good to have her here. First, we have the BioBusiness Alliance. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Dale Wallstrom, give your name for the record, please.
Okay. Dale Wallstrom. I am the CEO of the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota. And I would like to introduce Dr. Kelvin Willoughby, who will be co-testifying with me today.
My name is Kelvin Willoughby. I'm president of Willoughby International, which is a Minnesota-based consulting firm. I'm also professor of entrepreneurship and intellectual property at the Curtin Graduate School of Business in Australia. I'm a professor at the Technical University of Munich and at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University.
Glad to have you here.
Okay, this is our agenda for today, and I believe we have a half an hour, Mr. Chair. So we will try to wrap this up in about 20 minutes. We leave time for Q&A. For those of you, there are some of you I haven't met yet. I've been involved with the BioBusiness Alliance since 2006, actually 2005, sorry. My background is I come out of the private sector. I'm retired from Medtronic in 2006 and been involved in working with the request of or as part of Governor Plante's biosciences program, have been involved in this process ever since, and work closely with many of the members in this committee. So we're really glad to be back. We focus primarily on commercialization of technology, commercialization, and support the company startup. We'll get into that in more detail. This is our agenda. We'll talk about a little bit about what BioBusiness is, who the alliance is, what we do, and some of the accomplishments so far up to this point in time. The common link that brings us all together is the belief or the understanding that that we are in the age of biology. And that by itself allows us as a state to have great opportunities because we're very much a biologically driven state. In fact, you'll see this number later in Dr. Willoughby's information, but we are 43% more engaged in commercialization of bioscience-based technology than the average state in the union. Each one of these industries is based on that these ages as we move from left to right on this slide. Each one of these ages is based on the knowledge of the prior age. So right now, it's primarily driven by the information age. We now have the ability to work and understand what happens at the genomic level and the proteomic level so we can control outcomes and be able to engineer solutions that prior to this point in time were not available to us. Our product, our organization focuses on this. It's also very important to the state. We have just completed another assessment, which you'll be briefed on shortly. There's approximately 34,000 to 35,000 people in the state of Minnesota that are employed directly in the development of technology associated with the life sciences. Of that, there's about another 120,000 or so that are indirectly associated with that through the multiplier effect. The wages, on average, are about $62,000 per year. We have about 48% higher than the average wage, excuse me. And as a state, we have about $2.1 billion in payroll. When we talk about dependency, what we mean by that is that what I mentioned earlier, that as a state, as compared to the national average, we have 43% more of our economic connection is tied to the life sciences than an average state in the country. And Dr. Willoughby will share that more details around that in a moment. In our state, we have approximately 300 or 670 enterprises spread across the the state. The Alliance itself, who we are, we were created, as I mentioned, in 2005. It was an industry-led spin-out of Governor Plenty's Bioscience Council. We are an industry-led nonprofit organization. We partner very closely with other members of industry, academia, and the government to stimulate growth in this specific industry. As I mentioned, my background is out of the private sector. I was heavily involved in company creation and business creation inside of large companies, both large and small, actually. We have a strategic affiliation with Life Science Alley, as well as strategic partnerships with many other organizations around the state, such as the Minnesota High Tech, MinNano, and many others, ARI, to name just a few. We support these six industries: medical devices, biologics, biopharma, animal health, food, the bio-based energy and bio-based materials sectors. The thing, so what do we do? Fundamentally, we do three things, but they're all based on principles that are drawn from the private sector. Well, we first started out in 2005 by doing an assessment of the state to try to understand where does the state actually reside as far as our ability in life sciences and job creation. We did that because at the time there was a rumor, I guess you'd call it, spreading across the state that we're losing our edge. So we went out and got the data, and hence Dr. Willoughby, it was the first time we engaged in a relationship with him to go out and do an independent assessment of our state, and we'll get to that in a moment. Second thing we did when the data came back and wasn't so positive is we put together a plan. That plan became known as Destination 2025. It was just shy of a two-year partnership we did with Deloitte. What it does is it lays out a strategic plan for all six of those industries and the infrastructure that we as a state need to have in place to be able to grow and create an environment where those industries can prosper. And right now we're in the implementation phase. We released Destination 2025 in January of 2009. And we have been implementing ever since. The one point I'd like to make is that our assessment and our plan, specifically the plan and the tactics that we incorporate as we go forward and implement, is that we always try to leverage what we have, meaning that we spend a great deal of time understanding the assets that the state has, where our companies were, where our academic institutions were, where our research was occurring, where our tech transfer offices were at. Any asset that we have is where we try to focus and build on that first before we try to create new. Many of you have seen this before, and now I can say you've all seen it. This is a slide that for us is it's a one-page picture of what we do. This is an illustration of the life science community within our state. Starting at the top, these are the six industries that we support, that we work directly in, as well as there are supporting industries such as computer science and the like that support, that these industries leverage to be able to do their work. But that top box represents the private sector and the companies where most economic wealth, most job creation occurs at that level. The very bottom box, jumping in the bottom, the kind of orange-colored one, represents what we think of that as the public sector. That's where our capabilities in the area of education, infrastructure, policy, and whatnot reside at that level. The next box up is the what we call enabling knowledge clusters. That is the area where new knowledge is created within your community so that you can take that and convert it into jobs and economic wealth for everybody to enjoy. And in that large box in the middle, and I might add before I leave the academic sector, the enabling knowledge clusters, that's for organizations and partnerships that you've helped to fund, such as the Mayo Genomics Partnership as an example. They reside there because it's new knowledge generation that we are trying to leverage. The commercialization catalyst is where we spend a lot of our time. We spend it in the other areas too, but we really focus heavily on commercialization and trying to make sure that we have in place what it takes to support companies and bring out economic wealth on the other side. So there's so everything that we do, everything that's in our work plan, so to speak, is driven by the Destination 2025 strategic plan that is trying to either strengthen a weakness in this slide or to fill a hole that exists in our capability as a state. So what do? We assess. To start out with, as I mentioned, we started out with assessing where the industry stood in the state. We now have data that goes from 1997 through 2007. It compares Minnesota against the nation, as well as 10 other competitor states. And this is where I will introduce you now and turn the mic over to Dr. Willoughby, because Dr. Willoughby is an independent third-party person that we have worked with now since 2005, rather, to help do give us a periodic review of where we stand as a state.
Dr. Willoughby.
Thank you very much. The information I'm going to share with you are highlights from this report that has just been published by the Business Alliance of Minnesota. I think you have an executive summary. You can get the full report from the BioBusiness Alliance website. Let me just go straight to some highlights. When I was first employed by the BioBusiness Alliance 6 or 7 years ago, did the first study looking at the state's competitive position in biobusiness technology, the news wasn't good. Minnesota was losing competitive position compared to other states in the country. The main result of my study, based on the U.S. Economic Census data, is that there's been a turnaround in the second half of the decade addressed by this report, from declining competitiveness to increasing competitiveness. Let me give you some highlights. 23% increase in jobs during this second half of the decade in biobusiness technology in Minnesota, compared with a 1% decline in jobs in the same industries nationwide. Wages, there was a 57% increase in wages paid in the sector in Minnesota during that period, and a 66% increase in revenues to companies in the biobusiness technology sector in Minnesota. In all these areas, Minnesota outpaced the nation and other states, roughly double as productive as the rest of the country in wages and revenue to the state. I looked at the segments which make up biobusiness technology, and the most important one is medical devices. While the nation actually lost jobs, 11,000 in the second half of the decade in medical devices, 11,000 jobs. Minnesota gained 4,500 jobs, roughly. We're significantly outperforming the nation. And this is very interesting when you consider that the state was on its back foot in the first half of the decade. There's been a turnaround. 77% of Minnesota's biobusiness technology jobs are in medical devices, and this emphasis is twice as large as it is elsewhere in the country, and that's growing over time. In short, the takeaway message there is that Minnesota has got more at stake in both biobusiness technology in general and medical devices in particular for job creation and wealth creation than is the case in the rest of the country. What happens in this industry nationwide affects this state more than elsewhere. I also looked at pharmaceuticals. The pharmaceutical sector is rather small in Minnesota compared with its presence elsewhere in the country, and we're not usually considered to be a significant player. In fact, we're a small player. And 5 or 6 years ago, many commentators were saying Minnesota has lost its chances in this life sciences-oriented area of pharmaceuticals. Let's give up and do something else. But the numbers show, in fact, a resurgence. There's been a growth in jobs of 76% during the recent time. It's important to recognize that there's technological linkages between the medical devices sector and the pharmaceutical sector. So the growth of a vibrant pharmaceutical segment in Minnesota is important to the continued competitiveness of the medical devices sector. The reverse is also true. A healthy medical devices sector helps growth in pharmaceuticals. The study also looked at what I call agri-bio and bio-industrial technology. This is the application of biological technology to non-human applications. In Minnesota, the most important area is ethanol production. There was an employment growth of 44% in the second half of the decade. So once again, we're a relatively small player in this field, despite the fact that it's an important part of our mindset in Minnesota. We grew. It's a positive story. But other states are investing heavily, and and with intelligence in this area, and we are not as competitive as we should be in bio-industrial and agri-biotechnology. We're getting better, but others are more competitive than us. Research and development in the life sciences is the predominant research-oriented category. All the other numbers I've showed you are about manufacturing-oriented jobs. Minnesota is also a minor player nationwide in research and development in the life sciences, essentially R&D and biotechnology. However, as with the other areas, there was an above-average performance in Minnesota in recent years. The nation suffered badly in this field after 2002, losing 19% of its jobs in the period covered by this report. Minnesota, which started on its back foot, lost only 8% of jobs. So we did better than is the norm in the country, even though we were starting from a weaker position. There's something positive, something dynamic going on here. And this is reflected partly in the entrepreneurship which we've witnessed, 33% increase in enterprises, new enterprises. So we've got a resurgence in biotechnology-related research and development in the state. In conclusion, from a weak start in the first half of the decade, where other states were outpacing us, Minnesota has had an upswing in jobs, wages, revenue for companies across the board. With in the weaker areas of the economy nationwide, Minnesota outperforming competitors.
Representative Clark has a question.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Willoughby, you indicated that the 77% of the biobusiness jobs are medical devices. In light of the news today about you know, the questionable safety of a lot of medical devices, what is your response to that? Are we more at risk?
Dr. Willoughby.
My study did not look at internal operational issues inside the medical device industry, so I cannot give you a direct answer on that. I will have to defer probably to Dale Wallstrom on that. My numbers looked at jobs, companies, wealth generation, and relative position with other states. So I could say that while the industry nationwide has been suffering, declining, perhaps for these reasons, Minnesota has been using human and organizational talent to build up activity in the sector, despite pressures from regulatory environment and international competitive sources in this area.
Mr. Chairman.
Clark.
I understand maybe you don't, maybe you're not the person to answer this, but this didn't have to do with competition from other companies, this or other countries at all. It had to do with the safety, the human health safety of the devices. So if there is someone who can help us look at that, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Wallstrom.
Yes, a great question. That study that's being referred to in the newspaper and on the news last night was by Dr. Zuckerman, I believe. that study it's a highly debated study, and statistics every year are highly debated, and of course you have to look at both sides. But one of the statistics that she presented was that 71% of the devices that were recalled in the last, I think out of the last 130 recalls, I forget how many years going back that occurred, that 71% of those recalls were based on products coming through what's called the 510K process, which is a process that is requires less clinical study than does, say, a PMA, the way the media extracted that information, they made that sound like that was a bad thing. The reality is that non-PMA submission accounts for 92% of, about 92% of all the submissions and all the approvals come out of that process. So the fact that 71% of the recalls that are in there are coming out of 92% of the approvals would indicate that process that is under question right now is not yielding a higher safety outcome than, say, the more stringent policy which she's advocating for. The other part of that issue that's important, I think, to mention I just went blank. Well, that's embarrassing.
Yes, that's okay. We can talk later, Mr. Chairman.
It's a very, very important question to our state because the implications mm-hmm. of it are profound, mm-hmm. and the data that's being used is actually data that is being selectively presented to present a negative image of something that's being grossly overstated. Now I remember the second point I was going to make. Of the data that we have seen, we have people looking at the data that we have seen on that, on the recall that she's referring to, so far, of all of them that we've looked at, with just most of them, none of them would have been caught in a clinical study. They're all related to, most of them are related to an error made in the manufacturing process on labeling or something along that line that forced a recall, but it's not necessarily a safety issue. It's more of a, and so the argument that's being made is we should do more clinical studies versus using the 510K process. And it's a, there's a, actually a Senate hearing on it tomorrow in Washington, D.C. So it's great media coverage.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could wait till the end of your presentation if you're getting close to the end. I wanted to talk about the ethanol slide, but I can wait till you're done.
Maybe it's okay. Maybe we can wait.
Okay.
Okay. I wanted to just comment a little bit on this slide then, Mr. Chairman, that this slide is an accumulation of the five areas that Dr. Willoughby looked at, and it shows the makeup of the employment within our state. And it's important to note how they rank with the light blue. I'm sure you can see it. Light blue is devices. We are showing very nice growth in the purple or the bluish color, the darker blue, which is pharmaceuticals. But the device industry, before I leave that one, you'll notice that from 2007, the last 2 years that are on this graph are not based on census data. They're based on Dr. Willoughby going in and extracting information from existing databases and estimating or projecting forward what 08 and 09 will look like, because that's when the economic downturn really hit. And as you can see, we stayed flat, went down a little bit. As a nation, we went down a little bit more. But generally speaking, that industry is flat, and there's an expanded amount of international activity, other countries developing markets, developing businesses rather in that area. So it's an area of extreme interest to us to watch and grow. We're very pleased about the pharmaceuticals because it's an area we need to have. You know, much of the money that we are spending in our research areas, et cetera, is leveraging skill sets, leveraging the business infrastructure that comes from the pharmaceutical industry. The fact that Dr. Willoughby mentioned the R&D and life sciences, the yellow bar and the blue bar are both growing. Those are the biotech-based applications and pharmaceutical-based, and that's an area where historically Minnesota has been weak. And it's an area that our research institutions depend on to be able to commercialize their technology locally. So that's an area of intense focus that we have been working on and others have been working on for the last 10 years to try to get, or last 8 years, to try to get that industry going. And we're really happy to see the results. We're very concerned about the agribio and bioindustrial area. We are seeing some growth, but not the growth that we'd like to see in the technology side. We've seen manufacturing growth, but not those companies that spawn new technology. That's an area of weakness for us that we really feel strongly we have to go after. Things like second generation, third generation fuels, things like those type of renewable chemicals, such as replacements for polymers and plastics and those types of things, are a rapidly growing industry. And it's an area where, I don't know how many of you know this or not, but Minnesota is ground zero for especially the renewable chemistry industry. It started here. Originally, 18 of the first 18 companies that I'm aware of that were formed in the country in the area of renewable chemistry, 14 were formed here. Of the 14, five. I may have lost count there, but it's four or five have now left and gone somewhere else. And we really want to focus on that in the coming years to make sure that we as a state that initiated a lot of these industries are taking full advantage of the commercialization opportunity. So I'll stop on this slide, but it's an interesting consolidation of all of Dr. Willoughby's work, and gives us a general overview trajectory of where the industry is headed. Okay, so what do? We plan. We already talked about that, so I'm going to kind of skip over this very quickly and just say that Everything we do is marching towards a plan that's based on destination, called Destination 2025, and we're trying to fill holes and weaknesses and grow, provide growth opportunities for the state. Again, these are just some of the deliverables. We have more that should be added, but it's all been part of this process. So there are major deliverables and major outcomes that have come forth since our formation in 2005. When we approach our strategy and our implementation, how we implement, we really, now that we have passed from the assessment stage into the through the planning stage or into implementation stage, we have been since January 2009. Fundamentally, we do two things. We lead large projects that are targeted at either regional economic development programs that build something that a region can leverage, or statewide and statewide projects that have statewide implications, such as the Minnesota Angel Network, which was announced a couple weeks ago, to try to take advantage of the angel tax credit that you all approved. These are most of the projects that we're either leading or participating in while others are leading them. We always prefer to try to find a leader and then we participate, but in many cases we can't and we lead. So these are projects. We cannot measure accurately jobs created from these projects. We know that there are job creation occurring, but we can't measure it accurately, so therefore we don't present that data. We do present data, though, however, on the second thing we do, which is we give direct support to companies. And in the last 3 years, we have supported 193 small and startup companies across the state. The end of every year, we call them up and say, how many people have you hired, and relate it back to the support and the activity that has occurred over the last whatever that time frame might be. Those 193 companies, and now as of last December, reported they have hired 2,707 people. And I might add, I might have said that already, but they are all startup and small companies. They also, we ask them a second question: is how many companies or how many employees will you expect to create over the next 3 years? That number came in at 2,186. For a total of, by 2013, that the companies currently in the process will create somewhere around 4,893 jobs. Every year we add on to that number of companies, so that number will go up from that point. In addition, since January 2009, these companies have raised $133 million, and those are the three questions we asked. How many jobs have you created, how many will you create, and how much capital have you brought into your company? And that's the total as of this point. Those are hard numbers. So what do we know? We do know that the report that Dr. Willoughby did in 2006 was a real wake-up call for our industry, private sector, public, and academic, all three. There have been a series of recommendations that came out of that process then to try to figure out what do we do. We're in the midst of implementing them. As part of that process, we mapped and recorded all the assets Minnesota has, and I want to repeat that. That's a fundamental strategy of how we do work, is that we try to identify what do we have first and build on that. We only go out and recreate when there's a need to recreate or to create a new company or capability. As a result of this implementing of economic development strategy, that we are starting to see growth and opportunity occur within the state. So how do we support this as we look to the future? These trends that Dr. Willoughby presented to you are fragile. This industry, all these industries need support. It is a rapidly growing industry on an international basis. The whole bioscience-based industry is rapidly growing. So we need to support that. Things that we'd like to ask you to consider and to be part of is to continue forward with investing in the angel tax credit, the R&D tax credits, those types of incentive programs or things that encourage people to take risks with their own money. Those are the things that we think are important. We'd also like you to consider funding us, funding the University of Minnesota Mayo Partnership, some of the higher education bioscience programs that are coming in front of you, because all of that plays into creating an environment and an ecosystem that works. We also know that there's a bonding request coming forward for the University of Minnesota on the nanophysics building. We'd like to reinforce that that's a very important program capability at the U. The reason for that is all the industries that we support are either are already being redefined through nanotechnology and applications of working at the nanoscale. So it's very important. And lastly, we know that the Science and Technology Authority is coming forward for your review if it hasn't already. And that is an effort to try to take this type of an approach and expand it across all industries and include to be inclusive of industries across the complete continuum of the state. We think there's great opportunity for growth in that area, but also a great opportunity to also to add to the core competencies that even the life science industry needs to continue to grow as we go forward. So with that,
Mulry's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, either of you, I know that the university has been down in R&D in recent years in general. Is that true in this area or not?
Mr. Chairman? Okay. I don't want to speak for the universities or the academic institutions. I know that they're all struggling for funding and the like. The federal government's cutting back, state's cutting back. It's just tough. At the same time, this is an area of extreme high-level research right now across the globe. And the reason for that is because of the fact that this is an area that it's a new area of technological advance right now. In fact, we always say this, and it might sound cliche, but if you think back to what has happened to your life, all of our lives, as a result of the communications industry and the electronics industry over the last 20 years, and how it's changed everything we do. If we look back 20 years from now, the revolution that's currently taking place in biotechnology and biology in general will be as profound as what has happened to us in the last 20 years because of this industry. And in fact, this industry is being facilitated almost entirely by the advances that were made in the communications industry to allow us to process enough information in the area of biology to be able to control outcomes. So, yes, I can tell you unequivocally that every university across the globe is putting tremendous effort into this area, not as much as they want to, and not as much as they probably could, but certainly they're working it because it's pushing the envelope right now.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have great higher ed institutions in the state, but are we going to be able to produce the highly skilled people that we need to expand the opportunities in this field, or will we have to go outside of the state or around the world to get people to come?
Obviously, there's always room for improvement. As new knowledge comes out, you have to modify programs. However, Minnesota is number one or number two in chemical engineering in the world. Minsky system, our University of Minnesota system, we have a globally recognized or nationally recognized nanotechnology education capability. So rather than list everything, I can tell you that from an education point of view, our workforce is as good as or better than anybody except in one area. And that is an area of experience, because we have not had, on the private sector side, we haven't had the companies in that area to generate the trained workforce at the implementation level. However, that's, as you saw by the graphs in R&D and life sciences and pharmaceuticals, we're growing in that area rapidly, and that skill set is expanding. And I will also tell you there's a whole bunch of people across the globe, and we have a stack of resumes about that tall, people, Minnesotans, who want to come home. So as soon as the jobs are here, give them a call. So the answer is, yeah, we can find the workforce. We need to develop more of the hands-on experience.
Representative Mahoney. He wanted to be last.
No, I didn't. I just was waiting for his presentation.
Okay. Well, I can be last. Representative Paymar.
You can put me last.
I'm glad they are.
Mr. Chair, I thank you. I'm relatively new to this committee, so who funds you? I was looking in the budget book and didn't see that there was a state appropriation. Do you get any state money?
Yes, we do. We get about, well, we last appropriation we got $1.75 million.
$1.75 million.
Yes. That's a match. So everything we get, we at least match it with outside forms of funding, such as grants, donations, etc.
And Mr. Chair, and so is any of that match? So that match money, I'm assuming, comes from some of the businesses that you are also working to promote.
Some, yep. I want to be clear about something. The 193 companies, most of that is not charged because they're all startup and they don't have the money to pay. But we do get support from other companies who see the value in that.
Mr. Chair, do you get business support from the ethanol industry in Minnesota or nationally?
We have gotten support from corn growers, and we have and certain individuals in that area. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, when I can't remember what your name is. So you're when
Kelvin Willoughby is my name.
When Dr. Willoughby was talking about the that we're lagging behind other states and. In ethanol production, do you see a conflict at all with the fact that Minnesota provides a direct financial subsidy to the ethanol industry and your advocation of your comments about Minnesota lagging behind with the assumption that we should be providing, I'm assuming, more funding to the ethanol industry? Do you see a conflict at all?
I'd like to start. I would like to respond on one thing. I want to be clear about something. We're not lagging behind in ethanol production. The companies that we're, the jobs we're talking about here are technology-driven companies. So they are the companies that do the technology development. So as an example, if you take a current ethanol plant, there's a catalytic process that's used to break down and extract the sugars and create ethanol. Okay, the companies that we are behind on are the ones that are developing that new technology. We are not behind on applying it in manufacturing. So am I being clear? Is that clear?
Yeah, the comments were a little different than what the slide says. Mr. Chair, that's what I was asking. And so did you have an opinion on the current, given the fact that we're in the midst of a financial crisis in the state of Minnesota, and we're funding your program, which seems like it's doing good work at the tune of $1.75 million, but we're also subsidizing an industry that's already most of the plants are making, have already made a profit. Do you have a position on that as a program?
If I understand the question correctly, we don't support companies directly who are up and running and profitable. We support in the 193 companies that you're talking about, our focus is on new technologies trying to get off the ground, new entrepreneurs, new technologies they're trying to commercialize, where the vast majority of what we do is from that group, is to that group. We do very much think it's important to try to work with our existing industries to help them prepare for the transition that's taking place as we move to second and third and fourth generation fuels and fourth and technologies. That's an initiative left to materialize and get going. But that would be an area where we think that's a very important move, or we will lose over time much of what we have. And your question about conflict, I'm not sure how to address that. I don't see a conflict between that and. Maybe I ask you to clarify your question.
Mr. Chair, that's okay. I think some members in this committee who've been here for a while probably know my position on this. I was just trying to, you seem to be advocating for ethanol when I think this, it's a very controversial product that I think, you know, we spent a lot of money trying, and I know the chair has a different position on this than I do, but we spent a lot of money trying to develop in rural Minnesota, and for perhaps good reasons, but, you know, we're now facing a huge deficit, and we continue to subsidize the existing ethanol plants in the state of Minnesota. So that's why I was just trying to get at some of the this, you know, what their position is on that continued subsidizing of a profitable industry, and so that was my point. I think this committee, as well as this legislature, should think long and hard about whether we continue this subsidy to profitable ethanol plants when we're cutting every other place in the budget.
Representative Paymar, the number of ethanol plants that are subsidized by the state of Minnesota are very few. There is a big subsidy from the federal government, so you should address your remarks to the federal contingency that we have, because the 45 cents is a lot of money. I wish that would go away also. Then maybe ethanol can compete in a favorable lane. Representative Leidiger?
Sorry, an answer.
Okay, Representative Murray.
I was just going to follow up maybe a little bit on Representative Pinger's question. Back to the ethanol or agro-biodiesel, industrial. I'm going on another day. Dr. Willoughby, you talked there about other states are investing more intensely and more intelligently, and maybe you were alluding to how they were investing more intelligently in new products. Could you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Mm-hmm. Sure. May I speak, Chairman? Yes.
You will be next.
A couple of ways. We see some fundamental development work in this field going on in Minnesota, yeah, but expansion of jobs and enterprise and business activity in other states. And so there's a development of jobs in Iowa, for example, Nebraska. And we see revenue coming back into Minnesota from economic activities happening outside the state. So we're seeing some fundamental development work happening here that's useful for this sector. And I think the challenge is how to create the environment so that Minnesota is an attractive place for the job development and enterprise development to take place as well, so that we're making wealth for this state, not just through revenue being earned, but through jobs and direct business activity as well. That's one comment. The second one is that we have really three areas that are complementary. One is the fundamental research work, and everything in my report is private sector. It's not dealing with the universities or the government sector. So we have R&D in the life sciences, quite a bit of which is directed towards bioprocessing, not just ethanol, but other fields of biomaterials and bioenergy as well, the technological dimensions to which Dale Wallstrom referred. So we have some of this going on in the state here. At the other end, we have established rural industries, agriculture, forestry, food processing, forest products processing, etc. It's quite substantial and competitive. This middle area, which is the translation of the fundamental scientific and early technology work into practice in companies to feed the more established rural industries, this is where we're a little bit weak. Now, I'd add one more point to that. This sector, which I call agri-bio technology, 10 years ago, the ethanol part was only 10% of that industry. Now it's something like 60%, and the wages is I think employment of agribio is now more than half coming from ethanol. So I think what we're concerned about here is not whether or not ethanol companies get subsidized. It's not a question I'm interested in particularly. It's more what can this state do to stimulate the creation, the growth of companies that take the technology of bioprocessing into other fields, other areas of alcohol production and fuel production and other areas of biomaterials. So we've had this growing influence of the ethanol production in the state, in this segment. We need to put more effort on the technological development that will apply to other areas of biofuels and other areas of renewable biomaterials. And I think the fact that jobs and companies are flourishing elsewhere in the country and in the world means that some of the reinvestment of profits and
human activity is going in other states, not here. So we get some good early stage work, but it's this intermediate link between science on one hand and established rural and rural produce processing industries where we need to do some more effort. And it's not necessarily about subsidizing ethanol firms. It's about the technology that might be used by firms in biofuels and biomaterials.
Very well. Representative Mahoney's got a question. We got three, four other groups after you.
Right. And Mr. Chair, and I have three or four questions, but I'll really make one, and I'll make a quick statement. One of the things it highlights in your report is the hugeness, the 2,000-pound gorilla rather than 800-pound gorilla of medical devices in our state, and the lack of. My worry is that we have a very large industry, and if anything ever went wrong with that industry, you know, the other industries are not capable of picking up all that particular slack. But having said that, and in your report that you spoke to, the one that's online, you've got figure five, which is the employment, biobusiness, technology industries. And it, the thing that struck out to me is North Carolina in 1997 had 26,000 employees in that particular industry. Minnesota had 29,000. Today, North Carolina has 45,000 and we have 34,000. As I understand it, and I, for members of the committee that don't know, this has been an area that I've really focused on over the last 8 years. That is really troubling to me, and if you could explain to me and to the rest of the members of the committee what North Carolina did that we did not do, and how do we regain or put North Carolina back in its place? I mean, I don't mind getting beat in basketball, but I don't want to get beat in jobs.
Dr. Willoughby or whoever?
I'll take a shot at it first. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I would like to go on record, though, with the question that was asked earlier, that because I think that was the point, is that we are very much in support of and advocating for the growth of the biorefining industry, the ability to extract carbon from whatever that source might be and use it in other applications. And that's the basis of what the question really is. And we're very much in support of that. We don't have a position on, we don't get into the positioning on whether it should be subsidized or not. We're more focused on where the opportunities for industry growth are. Okay, back to the question for Representative Mahoney. North Carolina put a plan like Destination 2025. They put a plan in place about 25 years ago, and they've been gradually building their infrastructure, building their policies, building their funding mechanisms, building their support organizations. I don't know the exact number now, but 3 years ago when we, or 4 years ago, I guess it was, when we spent some time analyzing North Carolina in detail, at that point in time, the organization, which is the counterpart to the Biobusiness Alliance, had offices across the state, and they had something like 45 people at that point. The last I heard, they were well over 50, and it's all people who are helping companies get started, because a lot of the growth comes from startups. This is all new breaking technology, and a lot of it is in small startup organizations. So North Carolina's done a great job in that area. They also have done a great job early on of looking at combination products that are a mixture of pharmaceuticals and medical devices. And as a result of that, a lot of those kinds of evolving technologies are coming out of North Carolina and actually Tennessee, because they picked up on that earlier than we did. So they have, and also they're a great, they have timber and they have a lot of other biomass-based resources that they're leveraging. So, but the one thing that stands out in North Carolina or everything else that we've looked at is the fact that they put in a plan in place and they're marching to that plan and have been for 25 years. And they have systematically put one capability after another in place.
Thank you very much for your presentation. If any members have questions, I'm sure they'll be glad to come to your offices. And with that, we have...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Youth Bill. And we're going to try to get it done in 12 minutes or so. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Joyce Eisinger. I'm from the Carver Scott Educational Cooperative in Shaska, Minnesota. This is Stephanie Lund from Tree Trust. So first, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for letting us be here today. It's always a pleasure to come here year after year and talk to you about Youth Build. My school provides all the alternative school programming for the school districts in Carver and Scott counties, as well as special ed programs, current tech programs, adult basic ed programs, that sort of thing. And I have been there for almost 30 years, and I've had the good fortune to supervise Youth Build for almost 20 of those years. So I can come here today and honestly say to you that still today, after all this time, Youth Build is one of the best programs we have ever had the good fortune to offer. And we've had best results from this program than most other programs. I believe you do have the Youth Build annual report at your desk. And I just want to point out to you that summarizes each program's locate. The programs are located around Minnesota. There are about four programs in the metro area and the suburbs, and the rest are in greater Minnesota. And each program is summarized in that annual report. Near the back, there's a chart like this that will sort of highlight for you the results for next year. Do you not have that? Yes. You do have, okay. The chart just picks 1 year, 2010, last year. You can see that we served 394 participants in those 10 locations around the state. I'm not going to go through this whole chart for you. You can go through that yourself. I just want to point out to you that of those, most of those students are high school dropouts who have come to us. They have found very little success in their regular school, and they are looking for something else. Most of them are not employed. They have very poor work history. Most of them are in need of some pretty heavy-duty basic skill instruction. I think the thing that makes Youth Build so successful for us and all the other programs around the state is it's that combination of things that students need. One, it has the academic help that they need. Two, it has the career and workforce training that they need to get a good job. It has training involved in it that helps students become good employees and learn how to solve problems. We get community service and service learning involved in that because most of the students who come to us don't know what that's like to do something for someone else. So that's a big component of everybody's program. We also have a big component involving leadership development because we know that our students can be leaders. Sometimes they're leaders not in a positive way, and so it's really our job to turn that around. Last year, those 394 students around the state built 57 units of housing for low-income families. So I think with that, unless you have any questions for me, I'm going to turn this over to Stephanie from Tree Trust, who also has a youth builder with her today. Thank you.
Welcome to our committee, Stephanie.
Thank you. As Joyce said, my name is Stephanie Lund. I'm the Young Adult Programs Coordinator with Tree Trust. And through that, one of the programs I coordinate is Youth Build. We have had Youth Build for about 4 years, and in those 4 years, we've served about 100 young adults in Hennepin County, both Minneapolis and suburban Hennepin County. Similar to the demographics that Joyce listed, the average math level that our students enter our program with is fifth grade. Seventh grade is the average reading level, and we work with 18 to 24-year-olds. So these are students that have gone through the high school system and have struggled with school, possibly are struggling with passing their Minnesota Basic Standards tests, and traditional school isn't working for them. Tree Trust's Youth Build program is a little bit different in that we partner with schools that are alternative schools to provide a kind of alternative environment for learning. So our students work with us on an every other week basis, and they do housing, construction, and remodeling. Primarily in Minneapolis, to turn foreclosed and abandoned homes into first-time homes for first-time home buyers, families with low incomes. The success of our students, I think, comes from the fact that we have an ability through Youth Build to provide them more time to learn. They learn hands-on, and they learn through conversations with us, which is something that they haven't been allowed or able to do in their traditional schools. They have a community of support. They work on teams. They learn to do to be good team members, to become leaders. And on a weekly basis, we talk about a character trait, and they talk about how to be responsible or what that means to them, and we discuss really core values important for strong work ethics and engaging in their community positively. At the end of the program, all of our Youth Build participants should have a credential. We provide a credential in entry construction labor. They should have attained their diploma. They should have improved math and reading skills above fifth and seventh grade. They are expected to enroll in higher education or a vocational training program or attain stable employment. The majority of our students that successfully complete our programs do that across the state. So we work with students that haven't been successful in schools and help them become more successful in their community, in school, and in finding employment. The biggest, I think, outcome, though, is that we see that the students realize that they have potential and that they have abilities and that they can do things that they didn't realize they could do before. So they're much more well-prepared for adulthood, really. And additionally, they have a work ethic that they maybe didn't have before, didn't understand why it was important to have before. And they become to take a lot of pride in that and really enjoy working and volunteering and investing in their community. So to share his story, we have a current student that works with us. His name is Major. He's been with us since October. And just wanted to share a little bit of his story with you.
Welcome to the committee, Major. Will you give your name for the record?
My name is Major Knight. I've been working with Youth Build since I just started. It's like my first job. Like I couldn't find no jobs like when I was down in Minnesota because I come from New Orleans. So like this is like it gives me motivation to like actually try to find a job, you know. So what Youth Build has taught me was like actually before I even got to Youth Build, I wasn't even motivated. I wouldn't even like be sitting up here right now talking, looking at y'all and all that. I'd be like probably sitting in the back looking at the wall or something. But it taught me responsibility, respect, motivation, never giving up. A lot of stuff, man. Because like I wasn't even planning on going to college or nothing. Because like in Louisiana, I wasn't even thinking about college. I was thinking about like what I'm going to do tomorrow, or am I going to sell these drugs or something like that. Like, I'm actually thinking about going to college and being an electrician or something like that, and, like, getting enough money to help my mom out in her house or something like that, because, like, times are hard. So, what I'm going to do when I get out of here, when I get out of here, it's not F. But when I get out of U-Build, I'm going to use the money to go into my second year of college at MTTC. Probably take my career from that and probably go to the military.
Our next speaker with Youth Build is Jim Grosso from Guadalupe Alternative Programs in St. Paul, and he also has another Youth Build participant with him.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Jim Grosso, and I'm a carpenter with Youth Build. I'm the one that actually works with these students every day. We remodel about one house a year, and we take houses that are Category 2 and getting close to Category 3. We take a lot of time having the students do the actual building on the houses. The one we're in that we're just finishing now went all the way down to a complete gut. We actually had to prop the house up, dig everything out, put a new foundation in, and the students do all the work. Sometimes they do it twice, and sometimes they do it three times. But the whole goal of what we're doing is that they learn how to do what we're doing. I already know. I've been doing this since 1985. But they learn what we're doing. And then as a byproduct of that, we have a house that we can sell to somebody who maybe couldn't afford a house if it was done by somebody trying to flip a house. Plus, it's all done correctly. We get people that are licensed electricians, licensed plumbers come in, and everything is done up to code and everything is done well. So these people are buying houses that are good, solid houses. We even had the fun of a house, I think we finished in 2006. Some people bought the house. I was involved in that. And all of a sudden this young woman was coming to our school and she was living in that house that we had built. And that was exciting for us. And so that's what these students get to do. They get to see the finished product. And we've gone into some houses that don't smell very well, and they're all crooked and they're rotted, and we take care of them and we turn them into nice houses. But I have my student here, Drayvon Crenshaw. He will be explaining to you a little bit of the kind of work that he's been doing. He's been with me about a year and a half.
Drayvon, give your name for the record so we know you were here 100 years from now.
Well, this is kind of like my second year doing it. When I first started, we did insulation. I really didn't know what insulation was. I had no idea what it was. And when he first told us what it was, I thought about it as a, no, I'm not doing this. So during Youth Build, I became more as a positive, like, while in school, I didn't really do anything. I was always a straight-on kid. I do my work still. But, you know, Youth Build just give us that motivation to actually want to stay in school and graduate to get our diploma and go further on to being in this career as of construction, anything like that. So we've learned how to do trimming, you know, insulation, sheetrock, mudding and taping, spraying, stuff like that.
You want to give your, yeah, I think you did.
No.
You want to give your name?
Drayvon Crenshaw.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, well, these are the people that can answer the questions about the program, right?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alan Selinsky. I'm executive director of the Guadalupe Alternative Programs in St. Paul and also chairing the Minnesota State Youth Build Coalition.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah, any questions from the committee? Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do most of your clients come, or they do not have their high school diploma?
None of our students have had a high school diploma before they come to our program.
Okay. I'm somewhat confused because in my school district, the education dollars pay for these kinds of programs. Do you have education funding that comes with that
percentage? For our students, we can get education funding if they're up to 21 years of age. Right. Beyond that, we have to depend on other donations, including Youth Build state money.
However, educational funding cannot provide the tools that we need for the program, the wages that the students are paid. In our case, we're working in different locations, so we need to provide transportation in some cases. So there aren't enough educational dollars to run the whole program.
But they certainly help.
Yes. They do pay for the academic part of the day, and then Youth Build funds pay for the other worksite part of the day, typically.
Right. And let's say for our program, half day is spent in classroom and half day on the worksite. So, and then it's reversed for the afternoon crew.
Okay. Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe you could help me understand. There is the Guadalupe organization and the Tree Trust and Youth Build. Maybe how do those all sort of pull together? Does Youth Build sort of oversee all of them? Or how does...
It is a little confusing. There are 10 programs around the state, and the funds from DEED go to those 10 locations, and we're all a little different. In our case, we are a school. Guadalupe Project is a school. Tree Trust is a nonprofit. In Bemidji, the funds go to the CAP agency, and they run the Youth Build program. So we, although we're different organizations, we operate a Youth Build program. We are the school, so we provide the academic part of the program. In BICAP, they provide the work part of the program, and then they send their students to the alternative program to get their academic credits.
Okay.
Stendrick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was curious of those different locations where you're funding. I mean, how many offices or sites are there that you might actually pay for? And I was wondering what the number of full-time employees would be in your organization, because it sounds like you do a whole lot. I was just curious if you can quantify how many.
Within the organizations or within the Youth Build program of those organizations? Because a lot of them, the organization is much larger, and Youth Build is a component of that. If that makes sense. So within our organization, we have 32 employees, but there's only five specifically working on Youth Build.
Thank you.
Do you receive funding from the federal government or anybody like that, philanthropic giving?
We cobble together all the funding we need to make the program work. We don't get any federal Youth Build funding, but we do. We get federal lunch program funding for the lunches. We get this, that. So we try as best we can to get whatever funding we need to make sure that the program, which is a very comprehensive program, make sure that it all comes together.
We have many partners also over the years who have worked with housing, for example, the Scott County HRA, the Carver County CDA. All those programs are working together really to put this whole picture together. We built houses at our school, and then those houses would be moved to different locations within Scott County, and the Scott County HRA program would use that for those houses for victims of domestic violence, for example. So there's no way that any one organization could do this program on its own.
Thank you. Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also trying to figure out, and I'd like to pick up with what Representative Stenzer was asking. The way I understand it, you're organized as charter schools, both organizations. Alternate schools.
We are a cooperative.
We are a contract alternative school.
Different than a charter school, but similar.
Right.
Okay. And that's and those are, Mr. Chairman, can I continue? Those are both nonprofits, right? So you're.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Correct.
But you're housed, one is housed within the other organization, and then you serve statewide?
The Youth Build program has 12 sites statewide, and it's very confusing because the common component is the Youth Build program. Mm-hmm. It could be a CAP agency, like it could be any type of nonprofit or governmental agency that can run a Youth Build program, but in our case, it's a contract. A charter school could run, or an ALC, a public school, could run a Youth Build program.
Okay.
As long as there's the education component and the construction component or training component, that's what's the important piece, and leadership and some of the others.
Okay. I think I get it. Thank you.
Representative Sanders got a question, then we'll end up with you.
Very brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if you could tell me if you coordinate with any other OICs or if you operate separate from them, and if so, if you do operate separate from them, if you could help me kind of understand the differences between something like Youth Build and other opportunity industrialization centers.
Well, to be able to understand that, I mean, when we're saying that it's a little complicated, it is, because all of us partner with whomever we can. We partner with Workforce Solutions in Ramsey County. We partner with Xcel Energy. We partner with Inverhills Community College. You know, it depends on who is interested in working with our population. We serve probably the highest risk and least employable population in the state, especially now with the downturn in the economy. Our population, our demographic, was hit the hardest. We've had a glut of, we used to be a younger 16 to 18 to 19 year olds. Now we have a glut of 21 to 24 year olds simply because they were the first out when the economy went bad. So it depends on who you need. who we need to be able to serve that population better. That's who we're interested in partnering with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'd heard now several different streams of revenue that you folks have at least an opportunity to, it sounds like. Could you kind of give me just a rough estimate on what your total operating budget is and maybe what that includes, you know, the education dollars, the federal lunch money, the state appropriations?
How much in each category or just overall?
Just in general, your total.
This program generally it costs probably about $10,000 per student, which includes all of the education component, all of the training component. Here's some information.
You still have just been under $1 million, I think, and that's been pretty consistent for the last several years in the state. Mm-hmm.
But we leverage a lot of other dollars. With this, the training component is the least likely for us to get funding for. That's what Youth Build Minnesota has been doing for us. So the education dollars we get from, you know, Department of Ed, all of that. So this, just think of this as funding an area that is not very funded, that is the least funded out of our all those categories.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, do you have just a rough estimate then on what the total operating budget is? I understand there may be a variety of different streams, but is it
for
$4 million?
State, I have no idea what it would be for the entire state. Our agency budget, my agency budget, is $2 million. But this component of it is substantially less than that, about $400,000.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to call our attention to this cost-benefit analysis that was also handed out from this organization, and I think it's pretty interesting because the investment in Youth Build, it returns many, many times the cost that we put into it. And I was noticing in this cost-benefit analysis, it does leave out some things that really are a benefit, and one of them is, I think, there's a discussion here about avoidance of incarceration. I don't think that's part of the actual cost, and I know that's costing. If these youth were not productively employed, they could be costing us anywhere $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year for incarceration, depending on what the services were. But the other thing I made a note of is 57 housing units. If you think that they're about $100,000 approximately, that's another $5.7 million returned. I know it's not in your cost benefit analysis, and I just thought, you know, we should really count that as part of the benefit as well, because it's affordable housing to people who that wouldn't otherwise, we wouldn't have the construction done. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask people to look at that.
Can I also comment on that?
Very quickly.
That cost-benefit analysis was just tax rolls to the state. It was not based on the actual cost to society in incarceration, mm-hmm. Lost productivity, all of those things. It was just what it cost the state and how much they would gain in tax rolls over the life of that person.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. I think on page 17 of your handout, you'll find out what the total cost of the program is. Thank you very much for your enlightening presentation, and now we're going to do something a little different.
Thank you.
We're going to have Minneapolis Summer Youth Program and Learn to Earn at the same time. Efficiency is a scale. Welcome to the committee. Grab one of those chairs there and pull it up for yourself. No problem. See you later. Whoever wants to start, give your name for the record, please.
Sure. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ann Fisher. I'm the Youth Program Manager of Employment and Training Programs for the City of Minneapolis.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. With me today is Craig Ludeman. He's the Executive Director of Youth Care. And a Youth Care participant, Sandra Celeste, who's there. And you'll be hearing more from them shortly. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on the importance of youth employment and training. I really appreciate your time. Beginning in 2006, and each year since, the legislature has appropriated monies in support of summer youth employment. in Minneapolis. As a result, 3,250 youth have been afforded the opportunity to experience a paid work experience while learning about the important connection between school and work. In 2010, the city of Minneapolis received $895,000 in appropriated funds to continue that success that first began in 2006. It is our hope that full funding of our job creation efforts occurs in 2011, as it is more important than ever given the current economic conditions and the fact that more and more youth apply each year and are more and more in need of our services, it seems, every year. Realizing that need, Minneapolis has maintained a strong commitment to youth employment over the years. We believe it is crucial given the multiple barriers faced by inner-city youth, barriers that include concentrated poverty, chronic teen unemployment, and lack of educational attainment. Our summer jobs programs address each of these risk factors. Our comprehensive approach to summer employment is so much more than a paid work experience. Minneapolis offers youth the opportunity to earn high school credit, work readiness training that takes place prior to employment, wages that oftentimes benefits the youth's entire family, and most importantly, a work experience that teaches skills that will be used far into their future work life. Beyond the economic value that summer jobs provide, we strongly believe that a comprehensive summer jobs program is part of a public safety effort in Minneapolis. Engaged youth have less time to devote to non-productive activities. We firmly believe that our future workforce must not be lost, but rather should be part of a strategic plan to invest in a system that will ultimately benefit employers and whole communities. Our 2011 summer youth job application was due on February 4th of this year. We received approximately 3,800 applications. After spending this past week personally reviewing a few hundred of those applications, I can attest that the need to provide as many youth as possible with summer work opportunities is critical, as evidenced by the essay responses I read, by the lack of family income that was noted on those applications, and the general need for work readiness training, which our program does provide. Without the funding in question, approximately 650 fewer youth will be employed this summer. Helping to review the applications provided me with a good reminder that 650 is really so much more than a number. Each application represents a youth who is asking for a job in order to better his or her future. The youth who have applied for work this summer are at-risk youth, meaning 100% of those youth are economically disadvantaged. They come from families who have low income. They are youth in foster care. They are youth who have disabilities. They are juvenile offenders. They may be basic skills deficient, and they may be teen parents, as well as they may be English language learners. If funding remains intact, we expect these results. 650 youth will work for 9 weeks, having the opportunity to earn approximately $1,500. 650 youth will be taught work readiness skills prior to their summer employment. 650 youth will be connected to work sites where mentorship naturally occurs. All eligible youth will be given the opportunity to earn high school credit. In closing, please note just a few of our 2010 performance indicators and results on the handout that I have provided, and it looks like this. Only yours is in color, I believe. So in 2010, 650 youth were employed. They gained transferable work skills and obviously wages. All 650 of those youth received support services of some types. Most often it was in the form of transportation assistance to get to their job. And as I mentioned earlier, 650 youth successfully completed the work readiness training which we require for them to do prior to their job. You may also note that 85% of the youth last summer were from communities of color. The City of Minneapolis Employment and Training Program provides the oversight and the management of youth services, contracting with community-based organizations who actually provide the direct program service. We are fortunate to partner with many well-qualified providers, and one such organization is YouthCare. As I previously mentioned, here today is Craig Ludeman. who is the executive director of youth care, and Sandra Saliski, a youth who first participated in 2006, and as of 2010 held the position of assistant crew leader in youth care. She's now a student at the University of Minnesota. Sandra will speak to the benefit of summer work opportunities, and I trust that Craig and Sandra's testimony will provide you with a glimpse of the important work that really, really needs to continue. Again, thank you for the opportunity and to share the information, and I'll turn it over to Craig.
Thank you.
Craig, we got Learn to Earn here also?
Mm-hmm.
You're Learn to Earn. Okay, good. Go ahead.
Excellent.
Give your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Craig Ludeman. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Care, a nonprofit multicultural youth development program serving Minneapolis and St. Paul youth 13 to 18 years old. Mr. Chairman and members, I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about the important need to provide high-quality summer jobs for Minneapolis and St. Paul teens. I would like to note that Youth Care has been a proud partner with the City of Minneapolis for 36 years. Just a brief history, we were started in 1974 as a public-private partnership. I was one of the co-founders when I was in college, and this brought together Northern States Power Company, which is now Xcel Energy, of course, along with the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul to create a summer camp called Camp Sunrise for urban teens. Annually, the camp serves about 275 to 300 youth, and since 1974, over 10,000 Minneapolis and St. Paul youth have participated in an outdoor experience. Urban youth, mostly youth of color, 80 to 95%, many who have never had this experience before. Today, Youth Care is a year-round program serving 500 to 600 youth, 7 to 18 years old. We focus on providing youth with a sense of connection through positive after-school, weekend, and summer activities. And this is one of the key points I'd like to make, that many of the programs like Youth Care, other partner agencies, connect with youth during the summer, but keep those connections going during the fall, winter, spring through a wide range of educational, employment, and leadership activities. We provide youth with opportunities to become real leaders. We provide youth with relationships with caring adults. And we provide youth with jobs that are challenging and engaging. Today, Youth Care continues to have a very strong partnership with the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as Xcel Energy. But this partnership has broadened over the years to include, for example, General Mills, Best Buy, Wells Fargo, the National Park Service, McKnight Foundation, the Poled Foundation, 3M Ecolab, and many, many others. Today, Youth Care is considered a model multicultural youth employment and leadership program. I hope you can find the one-page handout that we brought that's entitled Multicultural Youth Employment and Training Program, because it has photos of four young people, youth who lived in the city, who live in the city of Minneapolis and were employed in the summer job program in 2010. Estefania, Yaya, Iris, and Pai Ying all worked at Youth Care last summer through the City of Minneapolis Summer Youth Employment Program. They look a lot like the other 35 youth who worked in our program and were employed and made somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 working last summer part-time. At the bottom of the sheet is a list of the skills that youth will learn through a summer job with Youth Care and with many other partner organizations. All youth, for example, will become certified in first aid and CPR. They'll develop financial literacy skills through workshops with Wells Fargo and Share Save Spend. The youth will work in a team and develop cultural awareness, leadership, and critical thinking skills. In their own words, Estefania learned communication skills and how to be a positive role model. Yaya learned how to work with a diverse group of people and self-sufficiency. Iris learned that being a leader also means listening and incorporating other ideas with her own. And Pai Ying learned that young people can become leaders by being active in their communities and giving back through community service. I'm stunned by 3,800 job applicants. Most of those kids are not going to get jobs this summer, which is, I think, unfortunate. But the 3,800 youth who have already applied in February for a 2011 summer job look a lot like Estefania, Yaya, Iris, and Pai Ying. These youth want to make a difference in their communities this summer. These youth want to develop skills that they can take into their future and become self-sufficient adults. These youth want and need a summer job, and they want and need your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome. Give your name for the record.
I'm Sandra Shashelsky, and I'm currently a freshman at the University of Minnesota,
as a work-study student now at Youth Care. And I started at Youth Care 4 years ago through the METP program, and since then I've worked every summer there. And it's only been my first job. I've only had one job. Well, it's been at Youth Care, but I've done various different jobs there. I started out as a youth mentor with the Young Women's Mentoring Program, which I mentored girls throughout the community in the Glendale neighborhood. And we did many different jobs, like I took them on field trips, we helped them with their homework, and just basically was a big mentor for them, like a bigger sister. And then just this past summer, I was a CSR, assistant crew leader, which was a lot of fun. I love coming back each summer. I had the opportunity through METP to come back and work with Youth Care, and I felt a big connection, as every summer you come back and you feel like you know the people that you're working with and the kids in the community, and overall you're just helping out your community while I was there. During high school, this was when I was working with METP, it was very hard to get a job outside of the summer. I had other things going on, and then just again with the economy, it was just hard getting a job, especially as a teen and not having like the experience. And with METP and all the resources and all the people that they know, all the experiences that I've gained, it's helped me broaden my awareness of what I can do and how I can come about a job and cooperate with people and just get my experiences out there so that I could go off to college and use it in other like career areas. I am an undecided major at the University of Minnesota, and as of now, I mean, I have different ideas, and with the METP program and all the different experiences I've gained with them and all the different careers that I've seen that they work with, and just throughout that, it's really helped me understand like what you can do out there. And not many people get that experience when you just go to school. Like, you just go to school and you learn. It doesn't mean you know what you can do and how you can work with other people out there and get the experience of having a job and using it throughout your life. Youth Care has provided me with many summer jobs, which I love, and I've gained great friendships and a lot of skills, and build my confidence with working with people and having leadership skills and all the skills that I have learned. It doesn't just go from working in a job. Like, I can use it in my everyday life and use it outside, whether it's with school and talking with other people, or just overall like helping me as a person. So you can use all the skills, not just with your job and how you meet people.
We're going to have to hurry it up a little bit, so we want to hear about the Learn to Earn program, and we got to leave money time for your sister city, St. Paul, so you got about 3 minutes.
Hi, I'm Linda Tatchik. I'm with the Minneapolis Park Board. I helped operate the Learn to Earn program, and just so in the confusion with some of the paper you have, the Park Board and the community know the Learn to Earn program as Team Teamwork. So that's where you see some of that people over there. Our program provides a learning rich summer work experience also for the youth in Minneapolis. Those youth have to meet the low income guidelines and at risk categories defined by DEED. With the $300,000 that we received last summer, we were able to provide 230 youth with a safe, structured work environment and provide them with basic work skills, encourage good work habits, instill in them a sense of pride of their accomplishments, and ultimately build in them a strong work ethic. Sorry, I'm not a speaker. One of the unique aspects to the Learn to Earn program is that youth are referred to us through youth servicing organizations throughout the community. We work with agencies like the juvenile probation system, school counselors, our own youth line mentors and outreach workers, to ensure that youth with the greatest needs and who are the most vulnerable receive this opportunity. And one of the benefits of having this employment program in our parks is that we are able to place youth at work sites close to their homes, so transportation is not an obstacle or another barrier that they have to face. The Park Board believes that this is one of the most important programs that we offer. The youth in our program are considered as, they're very valued and they're very appreciated, and they're a member of our workforce and in our community. All divisions of our Park Board get involved, so we're talking maintenance, forestry, environmentalists, planning, the carpenters, small engines. So youth have the opportunity to work shadow with a variety of employment opportunities within the park board. We have our recreation staff, youth line. So a lot of different experiences are given to these youth. Our program is continuously monitored and evaluated to make sure that the work experiences and educational sessions are relevant and benefit the community as a whole. We try to create a future workforce that is more employable, reliable, and understands what it takes to get and keep their next job. And we build relationships with other youth servicing organizations in our community to support our youth and to make additional resources available to them. We are an accredited learning center, and we have our educational component, and it's called, and that's where the Learn to Earn comes in. So all of our youth participate in the classroom setting, and our curriculum is all STEM-based, so we're talking science, technology, engineering, and math. They also receive basic reading, writing, math, and there's also a whole component on important life skills and work readiness trainings. Youth who participate and complete the program receive a high school credit. Want to hurry up because I want to get the pants. And again, you know, we hope to receive the $300,000 to enable another close to 300 youth to participate. Last year we had over 1,100 applications that came to us. Again, those were just, we contacted a few youth servicing organizations and our own youth line staff, and we were just flooded, and so we finally had to stop the application process because it was kind of getting heartbreaking for the youth. I brought with me a few of our prior members of the Team T-Works program, Learn to Earn program. I have with us Latrell Beeman and Charles Metcalf, and I want to make sure they have the opportunity to speak to you.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record. And
my name is Latrell Beeman, and I would like to say hello to the committee first of all. Hello, Mr. Chair. I have been a part of the Learn to Earn / TeamWorks project for about 5 to 6 years now. It's been a detrimental process to me as far as being, you know, outspoken and giving you those workforce needs and requirements that you need to progress in life. It is a great program. All the youth that participate in it love the program, and they come back every year. They try to come back every year if they can. And it is really a program that you can see the systemic growth. You know, instead of hearing about it or seeing the statistics on paper, you can actually see the growth in the youth personally. Because now I've gone on to work for the Park Board, and I still work with a number of those kids that I work with from my program and a number of kids that I work with after my program. So
you got a job with the Park Board?
Yes.
Could you give your name for the record, please?
Latrell Beeman.
No, I'm the other guy.
My name is Charles Metcalf. Basically, I've worked at the Learn to Earn program like last year, and I enjoyed it very much. The program has provided like great learning experience for me. It has contributed to my resume for applying to future jobs. It's positive. It's provided me with a mentor for like if I want to talk to somebody, you know, because it's hard out here when you don't have like somebody to really talk to and communicate with, I guess. So the program also is a great summer program. It you meet new friends, you learn like during the school, like the time that you would be out of school, you usually forget things, and like doing the Learn to Earn program, like when you're in the classroom environment, like over the summer, it kind of like brings you back into it, and like, you know, sit down, like learn. And then, like, you go back to school ready and more prepared. So,
my name is Charles Mick.
thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciated your presentation. St. Paul's, your turn.
Mr. Chairman, while they're coming down, just one point.
Sure.
One thing that tells me that these are important is that the Minneapolis cops tell me they're important. So, these government jobs for youth apparently have an effect on crime, at least in the cops' viewpoint.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Corum. I'm the Deputy Director for the Parks and Recreation Department. And I want to echo the sentiments of my colleagues in reminding you how important summer jobs are for young people. In St. Paul, we feel it's one of the most important programs that we provide for young people, particularly during the summer. We also have a few dollars that can help keep some of these young people employed year-round. And in St. Paul, this is really the only jobs program for young people that are 20 or 14 to 21. The $553,000 we received from the state of Minnesota in 2010 employed nearly 600 young people. Our partnerships with local businesses, community-based organizations, schools, Boys and Girls Club, help us place young people near where they live, eliminating transportation as a barrier. In St. Paul, we're very proud to state that nearly every penny of the funds we get from the state go to provide the jobs, which we think are the most important. You have a handout in your packets, and you can read a little bit more about what some of these young people were doing. But in 2010, the 600 kids that we employed were trained to remove invasive species, build rain gardens, serve summer meals, shelve books, and lead summer programs. They worked with our community partners to create video documentaries, build retaining walls, footbridges, restore shorelines, assist at food shelves, and become first responders and emergency medical technicians. More than 1,800 young people applied for these jobs, and we were only able to employ 600. It's critical that we continue to try to provide opportunities for young people to get work. It's one of the most important things for teens. In St. Paul, we look at the Youth Job Corps program as a focus in really three areas. As a youth development tool, it's a real out-of-school time learning opportunity where young people have the opportunity to apply the skills that they learn as well as learn new skills. Like our colleagues in Minneapolis, they have the opportunity to earn a high school credit. It's an opportunity for them to succeed and contribute in their communities, many of them for the first time. They're attached to a workplace, again, many of them for the first time, where their demands for their attention are real and they're held accountable. We also use it as a workforce development program. As one of the larger employers in St. Paul, we like to do our part in trying to prepare and educate our young people to be a part of the workforce. Some of our YJC participants earn certificates at a Horticulture Academy, the Eco Rangers Academy, and the Emergency Medical Services Academy. So St. Paul's really trying to do our part to educate and prepare young people for careers. Thirdly, as has been mentioned before, it's a crime prevention strategy and probably one of the least expensive crime prevention programs you could fund. For some of our young people, the job is literally supporting their own spending. For others, it supports a family, and for others, it keeps them from doing negative things that would cost the state a lot more. I'd like you to meet one of the young men I brought with me today, Donnell Gibson, who is a Recreation Services employee. He's a certified staff member as a part of my team. He's a recent graduate of the Emergency Medical Services Academy, and he's really what this program is all about.
Welcome to committee. Give your name, please.
My name is Donnell Gibson. Before I speak on what the program did to me, I'd like to congratulate the other kids that excelled in their program because they don't normally hear it from people that of their age. So, and another point that I want to point out is a lot of stuff that people was pointing on when I was listening that a lot of stuff that's trying to get excelled is for the betterment of Minnesota. So youth are the betterment of Minnesota, so a lot of these programs are needed, and there's no way we can excel if our youth are not excelling. Even if it's not the kids with the 4-point average, it's the troubled teams or the kids that don't have that push. We need them for Minnesota to excel. And also, what the program did to me, I'm actually working for Alina, and I'm working for Park and Rec. I'm actually saving lives, and I'm actually saving lives that are not emergency. So there are kids that was in the same predicament that I was in, homeless, have nowhere to go, have nowhere to eat. I'm a father of two, so I'm also a parent to kids at the rec center at the same time. So before the program, I was going to the seventh grade. I've been homeless until my 12th grade year of high school. I remember at times going into Rainbow, making meals in there to eat, getting picked up for curfew just so I have a place to stay. I know people look at the numbers that you get paid for working summer program and you think about that's not enough to
have a place to stay, but it was enough for me to eat. And on that note, I was able to survive a lot. I had a lot of people in the city. I had a lot of other kids that was in my same predicament that went off of my drive that I never gave up, and I never stopped looking for an opportunity to outlook for help. So every time I look around and I see other kids or whatever, I just let them know about my story. My mom and dad, they was had drug problems, and I also had two younger brothers I had to support. So I've never looked at anyone for help. I just always accepted it. I've never reached out for a handout. It's a lot of kids that are depending on that, but it's also a lot of kids that strive on the help that is needed. And when they get the opportunity, they excel on it. So if there's no opportunity for them to excel, there's nothing but troubled teens. Where people read and hear at-risk teens, and they think of troublemakers. And it's not on that note being as a troublemaker. It's not having the ability to excel or having the ability to better what you're good at. So some people don't have the opportunity to succeed. So I think if you cut out a lot of these programs, it's a lot of kids that are lost. And as Minnesota, we're not going to battle off of that, because the youth is what run Minnesota.
Thank you very much for your great testimony. We appreciate all that you have done.
Thank you.
Mr. Helgen, welcome to the committee.
Good to see you. It's been a while since I've been here. I'm St. Paul City Council Member Lee Helgen. I represent the north end, east side parts of the city. And I want to kind of talk to you as an elected official about the choices that you have in front of you looking at your budget and why this is important. First, what are your values that you bring to the table as an elected official? In this case, if one of the values you have is that young people should earn the value of a paycheck as a way to lead to self-sufficiency, then this program and all these youth programs are great first paycheck jobs. Without that opportunity to learn how to get a paycheck, how to manage money, their opportunity for success is greatly lessened. If you believe that the private sector should benefit by training a workforce, this program provides great opportunities that private businesses cannot do on their own, which is get these kids ready to show up at work, ready to be disciplined, ready to be working with their supervisors. And so we provide a lot of that base level training that isn't going to happen otherwise. If you think the dollars that we spend of public money ought to leverage other dollars, we do that. We work with many other nonprofits, foundations, other funders to try to leverage these dollars effectively. But in the end, what we're providing is jobs for 580 kids. The demand is overwhelming. We get normally around 2,000 kids who apply for these jobs. If you were to look at the local market, you would not find 2,000 job opportunities out there. If you make the decision to reduce this funding or cut this funding, you are cutting real live jobs. So if we didn't get this money, then we would not hire, 600 kids. They would be out of work. There would be no jobs. And St. Paul, we've been very committed to making sure that the money actually goes to their wages and that we provide those opportunities. So in terms of evaluating both the great testimonies and the impact on these kids' lives, the competent service providers that are working on it, and then your values about why we want to invest in young people, I think these are a great return for the dollars that you put in. And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity.
Councilman Helgen, how much does the City of St. Paul put in this program?
The City of St. Paul, we put in about $400,000 of community development block grant, so you're leveraging those additional dollars.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was an enlightening presentation. I'm sorry to everyone that we didn't have more time, but I'm glad we got you all in.
Thank you. I think so. He didn't say so, but either that or we're all
adjourned.